Over time, rules come to have an arbitrary life of their own, and the force of legal authority, even when they are no longer relevant, are vague or change with the whims of the enforcers. Our guards could justify most of the harm they did to the prisoners by referencing the rules. Recall, for example, the agony the prisoners had to endure to memorize the set of 17 arbitrary rules that the guards and the warden had invented. Consider also the misuse of Rule 2 about eating at mealtimes to punish Clay 416 for refusing to eat his filthy sausages. Some rules are essential for the effective coordination of social behavior, such as audiences listening while performers speak, drivers stopping at red traffic lights, and people not cutting into queues. However, many rules are merely screens for dominance by those who make them or those charged with enforcing them. Naturally, the last rule, as with the SPE rules, always includes punishment for violation of the other rules. Therefore, there must be someone or some agency willing and able to administer such punishment, ideally doing so in a public arena that can serve to deter other potential rule breakers. The comedian Lenny Bruce had a funny routine describing the development of rules to govern who could and could not throw shit over fences onto a neighbor's property. He described the creation of police as guardians of the "no shit in my backyard" rule. The rules and their enforcers are inherent in situational power. However, it is the system that hires the police and creates the prisons for convicted rule breakers. When roles become real. Once you put a uniform on and are given a role, I mean a job, saying your job is to keep these people in line, then you're certainly not the same person if you're in street clothes and in a different role. You really become that person once you put on the khaki uniform, you put on the glasses, you take the nightstick, and you act the part. That's your costume, and you have to act accordingly when you put it on. Guard Hellman. When actors enact a fictional character, they often have to take on roles that are dissimilar to their sense of personal identity. They learn to talk, walk, eat, and even to think and to feel as demanded by the role they are performing. Their professional training enables them to maintain the separation of character and identity, to keep self in the background while playing a role that might be dramatically different from who they really are. However, there are times when, even for some trained professionals, those boundaries blur and the role takes over even after the curtain comes down or the camera's red light goes off. They become absorbed in the intensity of the role, and their intensity spills over to direct their offstage life. The play's audience ceases to matter because the role is now within the actor's mind. A fascinating example of this effect of a dramatic role becoming a tad too real comes from the British television series The Edwardian Country House. 19 people, chosen from some 8,000 applicants, lived the lives of British servants working on a posh country estate in this reality television drama. Although the person chosen to play the head butler in charge of the staff expected to follow the period's rigidly hierarchical standards of behavior, he was frightened by the ease with which he became an autocratic master. This 65-year-old architect was not prepared to slip so readily into a role that allowed him to exercise absolute power over a household of underservants whom he bossed. Suddenly you realize that you don't have to speak. All I had to do was lift my finger up and they would keep quiet. And that is a frightening thought. It's appalling. A young woman who played the role of a housemaid, but who in real life is a tourist information officer, began to feel like an invisible person. She described how she and the others so quickly adapted to their subservient role. "I was surprised, then scared at the way we all became squashed. We learned so quickly that you don't answer back, and you feel subservient." Typically, roles are tied to specific situations, jobs, and functions, such as being a professor, doorman, cab driver, minister, social worker, or porn actor. They are enacted when one is in that situation, at home, school, church, or factory, or on stage. Roles can usually be set aside when one returns to his or her normal other life. Yet some roles are insidious, are not just scripts that we enact only from time to time. They can become who we are most of the time. They are internalized even as we initially acknowledge them as artificial, temporary, and situationally bound. We become father, mother, son, daughter, neighbor, boss, worker, helper, healer, whore, soldier, beggar man, thief, and many more. To complicate matters further, we all must play multiple roles, some conflicting, some that may challenge our basic values and beliefs. As in the SPE, what starts out as the just playing a role caveat to distinguish it from the real individual can have a profound impact when the role behavior gets rewarded. The class clown gets attention he can't get from displaying special academic talents, but then is never again taken seriously. Even shyness can be a role initially enacted to avoid awkward social encounters, a situational awkwardness, and when practiced enough, the role morphs into a shy person. Just as discomforting, people can do terrible things when they allow the role they play to have rigid boundaries that circumscribe what is appropriate, expected, and reinforced in a given setting. Such rigidity in the role shuts off the traditional morality and values that govern their lives when they are in normal mode. The ego defense mechanism of compartmentalization allows us to mentally bind conflicting aspects of our beliefs and experiences into separate chambers that prevent interpretation or crosstalk. A good husband can then be a guiltless adulterer. A saintly priest can then be a lifelong pederast. A kindly farmer can then be a heartless slave master. We need to appreciate the power that role-playing can have in shaping our perspectives, for better as well as for worse, as when adopting the teacher or nurse role translates into a life of sacrifice for the good of one's students and patients. Role transitions from healer to killer. The worst-case scenario was the Nazi SS doctors who were assigned the role of selecting concentration camp inmates for extermination or for experiments. They were socialized away from their usual healing role into the new role, assisting with killing, by means of a group consensus that their behavior was necessary for the common good, which led them to adopt several extreme psychological defenses against facing the reality of their complicity in the mass murder of Jews. Again, we turn to the detailed account of these processes by social psychiatrist Robert J. Lifton. When a new doctor would come on the scene and be initially horrified by what he witnessed, he would ask, "How can these things be done here?" Then there was something like a general answer, which clarified everything. What is better for him, the prisoner, whether he croaks, verreckt, in shit, or goes to heaven in a cloud of gas? And that settled the whole matter for the initiates, Eingeweihten. Mass killing was the unyielding fact of life to which everyone was expected to adapt. Framing the genocide of the Jews as the final solution, Endlösung, served a dual psychological purpose. It stood for mass murder without sounding or feeling like it, and it kept the focus primarily on problem-solving. It transformed the whole matter into a difficult problem that had to be solved by whatever means were necessary to achieve a pragmatic goal. The intellectual exercise deleted emotions and compassion from the doctor's daily rounds. However, their job in selecting inmates for annihilation was both so onerous, so associated with extraordinary evil, that these highly educated doctors had to utilize every possible psychological defense against avoiding the reality of their complicity in these murders. For some, psychic numbing, detaching effect from cognition, became the norm. For others, there was a schizophrenic solution of doubling. The polarities of cruelty and decency in the same doctor at different times would call forth two radically different psychological constellations within the self, One based on values generally accepted and the education and background of a normal person. The other based on this Nazi Auschwitz ideology with values quite different from those generally accepted. These twin tendencies shifted back and forth from day to day. Reciprocal roles and their scripts. It is also the case that some roles require reciprocal partnerships. For the guard role to have meaning, somebody has to play prisoner. One can't be a prisoner unless someone is willing to be the guard. In the SPE, no explicit training was required for the performance of roles, no manual of best practices. Recall on day one the awkwardness of the guards and the prisoners' frivolity as each were feeling out their new strange roles. However, very soon our participants were able to slip easily into their roles as the nature of the power differential at the base of the guard-prisoner symbiosis became clearer. The initial script for guard or prisoner role-playing came from the participants' own experiences with power and powerlessness, of their observations of interactions between parents, traditionally dad is guard, mom the prisoner, of their responses to the authority of doctors, teachers, and bosses, and finally from the cultural inscriptions written upon them by movie accounts of prison life. Society had done the training for us. We had only to record the extent of their improvisation with the roles they played as our data. There is abundant evidence that virtually all of our participants at one time or another experienced reactions that went well beyond the surface demands of role-playing and penetrated the deep structure of the psychology of imprisonment. Initially, some of the guards' reactions were probably influenced by their orientation, which outlined the kind of atmosphere we wished to create in order to simulate the reality of imprisonment. But whatever general demands those stage settings may have outlined for them to be good actors, they should not have been operative when the guards were in private or believed that we were not observing them. Post-experimental reports told us that some guards had been especially brutal when they were alone with a prisoner on a toilet run outside the yard, pushing him into a urinal or against a wall. The most sadistic behaviors we observed took place during the late night and early morning shifts, when, as we learned, the guards didn't believe that we were observing or recording them, in a sense when the experiment was off. In addition, we have seen that guard abuse of prisoners escalated to new, higher levels each day, despite the prisoners' non-resistance and the obvious signs of their deterioration as the full catastrophe of imprisonment was achieved. In one taped interview, a guard laughingly recalled apologizing for having pushed a prisoner on the first day, but by day four, he thought nothing of shoving them around and humiliating them. Craig Haney's discerning analysis reveals the transformation in the power infusing the guards. Consider this encounter with one of them that took place after only a few days into the study. Just as with the prisoners, I also had interviewed all of the guards before the experiment began, and felt I had gotten to know them as individuals, albeit only briefly. Perhaps because of this, I really felt no hostility toward them as the study proceeded, and their behavior became increasingly extreme and abusive. But it was obvious to me that because I insisted on talking privately with the prisoners, ostensibly counseling them, and occasionally instructed the guards to refrain from their especially harsh and gratuitous mistreatment, they now saw me as something of a traitor. Thus, describing an interaction with me, one of the guards wrote in his diary, "The psychologist rebukes me for handcuffing and blindfolding a prisoner before leaving the counseling office, and I resentfully reply that it is both necessary for security and my business anyway." Indeed, he had told me off. In a bizarre turn of events, I was put in my place for failing to uphold the emerging norms of a simulated environment I had helped to create by someone whom I had randomly assigned to his role. In considering the possible biasing of the guard orientation, we are reminded that the prisoners had no orientation at all. What did they do when they were in private and could escape the oppression they repeatedly experienced on the yard? Rather than getting to know one another and discussing non-prison realities, we learned that they obsessed about the vicissitudes of their current situation. They embellished their prisoner role rather than distancing from it. So, too, with our guards. Information we gathered about them when they were in their quarters preparing to enter or leave a shift reveals that they rarely exchanged personal, non-prison information. Instead, they talked about problem prisoners, upcoming prison issues, reactions to our staff, never the usual guy stuff that college students might have been expected to share during a break. They did not tell jokes, laugh, or reveal any personal emotion to their peers, which they easily could have done to lighten the situation or distance themselves from the role. Recall Christina Maslach's earlier description of the transformation of the sweet, sensitive young man she had just met into the brutish John Wayne once he was in uniform and in his power spot on the yard. Adult role-playing in the SPE. I want to add two final points about the power of roles and the use of roles to justify transgression before moving to our final lessons. Let's go beyond the roles our volunteers played to recall the roles played to the hilt by the visiting Catholic priest, the head of our parole board, the public defender, and the parents on visiting nights. The parents not only accepted our show of the prison situation as benign and interesting rather than hostile and destructive, but they allowed us to impose a set of arbitrary rules on them, as we had done to their children, to constrain their behavior. We counted on their playing the embedded roles of conforming, law-abiding, middle-class citizens who respect authority and rarely challenge the system directly. Similarly, we knew that our middle-class prisoners were unlikely to jump the guards directly even when they were desperate and outnumbered them by as much as 9-2 when a guard was off the yard. Such violence was not part of their learned role behavior, as it might have been with lower-class participants, who would be more likely to take matters into their own hands. There was not even evidence that the prisoners even fantasized such physical attacks. The reality of any role depends on the support system that demands it and keeps it in bounds, not allowing alternate reality to intrude. Recall that when the mother of prisoner Rich, 1037, complained about his sad state, I spontaneously activated my institutional authority role and challenged her observation, implying that there must have been a personal problem with 1037, not an operational problem with our prison. In retrospect, my role transformation from usually compassionate teacher to data-focused researcher to callous prison superintendent was most distressing. I did improper or bizarre things in that new, strange role, such as undercutting this mother's justified complaints and becoming agitated when the Palo Alto police officer refused my request to move our prisoners to the city jail. I think that because I so fully adopted the role, it helped to make the prison work as well as it did. However, by adopting that role, with its focus on the security and maintenance of my prison, I failed to appreciate the need to terminate the experiment as soon as the second prisoner went over the edge. Roles and responsibility for transgressions. To the extent that we can both live in the skin of a role and yet be able to separate ourselves from it when necessary, we are in a position to explain away our personal responsibility for the damage we cause by our role-based actions. We abdicate responsibility for our actions, blaming them on that role, which we convince ourselves is alien to our usual nature. This is an interesting variant of the Nuremberg trial defense of the Nazi SS leaders. I was only following orders. Instead, the defense becomes, "Don't blame me. I was only playing my role at that time in that place. That isn't the real me." Remember Hellman's justification for his abusive behavior toward Clay 416 that he described in their television interview? He argued that he had been conducting little experiments of my own to see how far he could push the prisoners so that they might rebel and stand up for their rights. In effect, he was proposing that he had been mean to stimulate them to be good. Their rebellion would be his primary reward for being so cruel. Where is the fallacy in this post-hoc justification? It can be readily exposed in how he handled the Sausage Rebellion by Clay 416 and Sarge's Bastard Rebellion, not with admiration for their standing up for rights or principles, but rather with rage and more extreme abuse. Here, Guard Hellman was using the full power of being the ultimate guard, able to go beyond the demands of the situation to create his own little experiment to satisfy his personal curiosity and amusement. In a recent interview with a reporter from the Los Angeles Times on a retrospective investigation of the aftermath of the SPE, Hellman and Doug 8612 both offered the same reasoning for why they acted as they did, the one being cruel, the other crazy. They were merely acting those roles to please Zimbardo. Could be. Maybe they were acting new parts in the Japanese movie Rashomon, where everyone has a different view of what really happened. Anonymity and de-individuation. In addition to the power of rules and roles, situational forces mount in power with the introduction of uniforms, costumes, and masks, all disguises of one's usual appearance that promote anonymity and reduce personal accountability. When people feel anonymous in a situation, as if no one is aware of their true identity, and thus that no one probably cares, they can more easily be induced to behave in antisocial ways. This is especially so if the setting grants permission to enact one's impulses or to follow orders or implied guidelines that one would usually disdain. Our silver reflecting sunglasses were one such tool for making the guards, the warden, and me seem more remote and impersonal in our dealings with the prisoners. Their uniforms gave the guards a common identity, as did the necessity of referring to them in the abstract as Mr. Correctional Officer. A body of research, to be explored in a later chapter, documents the excesses to which de-individuation facilitates violence, vandalism, and stealing in adults as in children, when the situation supports such antisocial actions. You may recognize this process in literature as William Golding's Lord of the Flies. When all members of a group of individuals are in a de-individuated state, their mental functioning changes. They live in an expanded present moment that makes past and future distant and irrelevant. Feelings dominate reason, and action dominates reflection. In such a state, the usual cognitive and motivational processes that steer their behavior in socially desirable paths no longer guide people. Instead, their Apollonian rationality and sense of order yield to Dionysian excess and even chaos. Then it becomes as easy to make war as to make love, without considering the consequences. I am reminded of a Vietnamese saying attributed to the Buddhist monk Thich Nhat Hanh. In order to fight each other, baby chicks of the same mother hen paint their faces different colors. It is a quaint way to describe the role of de-individuation in facilitating violence. It is worth noticing, as we shall see, that one of the guards in the infamous Tier 1A at Abu Ghraib's torture center painted his face silver and black in the pattern of the rock group Insane Clown Posse while he was on duty and posed for one of the many photos that documented prisoner abuse. We will have much more to say later about de-individuation processes as they contributed to the Abu Ghraib abuses. Cognitive dissonance that rationalizes evil. An interesting consequence of playing a role publicly that is contrary to one's private beliefs is the creation of cognitive dissonance. When there is a discrepancy between our behavior and beliefs, and when actions do not follow from relevant attitudes, a condition of cognitive dissonance is created. Dissonance is a state of tension that can powerfully motivate change, either in one's public behavior or in one's private views, in efforts to reduce the dissonance. People will go to remarkable lengths to bring discrepant beliefs and behavior into some kind of functional coherence. The greater the discrepancy, the stronger the motivation to achieve consonance, and the more extreme changes we can expect to see. There is little dissonance if you harm someone when you have a lot of good reasons. Your life was being threatened. It was part of your job as a soldier. You were ordered to act by a powerful authority, or you were given ample rewards for an action that was contrary to your pacifist beliefs. Oddly enough, the dissonance effect becomes greater as the justification for such behavior decreases. For instance, when a repugnant action is carried out for little money, without threat, and with only minimally sufficient justification or inadequate rationale provided for the action. Dissonance mounts, and the attempts to reduce it are greatest, when the person has a sense of free will, or when she or he does not notice or fully appreciate the situational pressures urging enactment of the discrepant action. When the discrepant action has been public, it cannot be denied or modified. Thus, the pressure to change is exerted on the softer elements of the dissonance equation, the internal, private elements, values, attitudes, beliefs, and even perceptions. An enormous body of research supports such predictions. How could dissonance motivate the changes we observed in our SPE guards? They had freely volunteered to work long, hard shifts for a small wage of less than $2 an hour. They were given minimal direction on how to play their difficult role. They had to sustain the role consistently over 8-hour work shifts for days and nights whenever they were in uniform, on the yard, or in the presence of others, whether prisoners or parents or other visitors. They had to return to that role after 16-hour breaks from the SPE routine when they were off duty. Such a powerful source of dissonance was probably a major cause for internalizing the public role behaviors and for providing private supporting cognitive and affective response styles that made for the increasingly assertive and abusive behavior over time. There is more. Having made the commitment to some action dissonant with their personal beliefs, guards felt great pressure to make sense of it, to develop reasons why they were doing something contrary to what they really believed and what they stood for morally. Sensible human beings can be deceived into engaging in irrational actions under many disguised dissonance commitment settings. Social psychology offers ample evidence that when that happens, smart people do stupid things, sane people do crazy things, and moral people do immoral things. After they have done them, they offer good rationalizations of why they did what they cannot deny having done. People are less rational than they are adept at rationalizing, explaining away discrepancies between their private morality and actions contrary to it. Doing so allows them to convince themselves and others that rational considerations guided their decision. They are insensitive to their own strong motivation to maintain consistency in the face of such dissonance. The power of social approval. Typically, people are also unaware of an even stronger force playing on the strings of their behavioral repertoire, the need for social approval. The need to be accepted, liked, and respected, to seem normal and appropriate, to fit in, is so powerful that we are primed to conform to even the most foolish and outlandish behaviors that strangers tell us is the right way to act. We laugh at the many candid camera episodes that reveal this truth, but rarely do we notice the times we ourselves are the candid camera stars in our own lives. In addition to the dissonance effects, pressures to conform were also operative on our guards. Group pressure from other guards placed significant importance on being a team player, conforming to an emergent norm that demanded dehumanizing the prisoners in various ways. The good guard was a group deviant, and he suffered in silence by being outside the socially rewarding circle of the other guards on his shift. the tough guard on each shift was emulated by at least one other guard on each shift. The social construction of reality. The power that the guards assumed each time they donned their military-style uniforms was matched by the powerlessness the prisoners felt when wearing their wrinkled smocks with ID numbers sewn on their fronts. The guards had billy clubs, whistles, and sunglasses that disguised their eyes. The prisoners had a chained ankle and a stocking cap to contain their long hair. These situational differences were not inherent in the cloth or the hardware. Rather, the source of their power is to be found in the psychological material that went into each group's subjective constructions of the meaning of these uniforms. To understand how much situations matter, we need to discover the ways in which any given behavioral setting is perceived and interpreted by the people acting within it. It is the meaning that people assign to various components of the situation that creates its social reality. Social reality is more than a situation's physical features. It is the way the actors view their situation, their current behavioral stage, which engages a variety of psychological processes. Such mental representations are beliefs that can modify how any situation is perceived, usually to make it fit or be assimilated into the actor's expectations and personal values. Such beliefs create expectations, which in turn can gain strength when they become self-fulfilling prophecies. For example, in a famous experiment by the psychologist Robert Rosenthal and the school principal Lenore Jacobson, when teachers were led to believe that certain children in their elementary school classes were late bloomers, those children actually came to excel academically, even though researchers had chosen their names at random. The teachers' positive conceptions of the latent talent of these children fed back to modify their behavior toward these children in ways that fostered the children's enhanced academic performance. Thus, this group of ordinary pupils proved the Pygmalion effect by becoming what they were expected to be, academically outstanding. Sadly, the opposite is likely to occur even more frequently when teachers expect poor performance from certain kinds of pupils, from minority backgrounds, or in some classes even from male students. Teachers then unconsciously treat them in ways that validate those negative stereotypes, and those students perform less well than they are capable. In the SPE, the student volunteers could have elected to quit at any time. No guns or legal statutes bound them to their imprisonment, only a subject selection form on which they promised to do their best to last the full 2 weeks. The contract was merely a research contract between university researchers, a university human subjects research committee, and university students. All assumed initially that they could exercise free will and leave whenever they chose not to continue. However, as was obvious in the events that unfolded on the second day, the prisoners came to believe that it was a prison being run by psychologists and not by the state. They persuaded themselves, based on the quip by Doug 8612, that no one could leave of his own volition. Thus, none of them ever said, "I quit this experiment." Instead, the exit strategy for many became the passive one of forcing us to release them because of their extreme psychological distress. Their social construction of this new reality cemented them in the oppressive situation being created by the guards' capricious and hostile actions. The prisoners themselves became their own guards. Another aspect of the way social reality was constructed in this research lies in the release deal that prisoners were offered at the end of their parole hearing. We framed the situation in terms of the power of the parole board to grant a parole if a prisoner were willing to forfeit all the money he had earned as a prisoner. Even though most acquiesced to this deal, being willing to leave without any remuneration for the days they had in fact worked as research subjects, none made the slightest attempt to leave at that point, to quit the experiment. Instead, they accepted the social reality of parole over that of personal liberty to act in one's best self-interest. Each one allowed himself to be handcuffed, his head hooded, and led away from this near freedom back down to the prison dungeon. Dehumanization. The other as nothing worthwhile. Kill a gook for God. Penned on helmet of a U.S. soldier in Vietnam. One of the worst things that we can do to our fellow human beings is deprive them of their humanity, render them worthless by exercising the psychological process of dehumanization. This occurs when the others are thought not to possess the same feelings, thoughts, values, and purposes in life that we do. Any human qualities that these others share with us are diminished or are erased from our awareness. This is accomplished by the psychological mechanisms of intellectualization, denial, and the isolation of affect. In contrast to human relationships, which are subjective, personal, and emotional, dehumanized relationships are objectifying, analytical, and empty of emotional or empathetic content. To use Martin Buber's terms, humanized relationships are I-thou, while dehumanized relationships are I-it. Over time, the dehumanizing agent is often sucked into the negativity of the experience, and then the I itself changes to produce an it-it relationship between objects, or between agency and victim. The misperception of certain others as subhuman, bad humans, inhuman, infrahuman, dispensable, or animals is facilitated by means of labels, stereotypes, slogans, and propaganda images. Sometimes dehumanization serves an adaptive function for an agent who must suspend his or her usual emotional response in an emergency, a crisis, or a work situation that demands invading the privacy of others. Surgeons may have to do so when performing operations that violate another person's body, as may first responders to a disaster. The same is often true when a job requires processing large numbers of people in one's caseload or daily schedule. Within some caring professions, such as clinical psychology, social work, and medicine, this process is called detached concern. The actor is put into the paradoxical position of having to dehumanize clients in order to better assist or cure them. Dehumanization typically facilitates abusive and destructive actions toward those so objectified. It is hard to imagine that the following characterizations made by our guards were directed toward their prisoners, other college students who, but for a fateful coin flip, would have been wearing their uniforms. I made them call each other names and clean toilets out with their bare hands. I practically considered the prisoners cattle, and I kept thinking I have to watch out for them in case they try something. Or from another of the SPE guards, I was tired of seeing the prisoners in their rags and smelling the strong odors of their bodies that filled the cells. I watched them tear at each other on orders given by us. The Stanford prison experiment created an ecology of dehumanization, just as real prisons do, in a host of direct, constantly repeated messages. It started with the loss of freedom and extended to the loss of privacy, and finally to the loss of personal identity. It separated inmates from their past, their community, and their families, and substituted for their normal reality a current reality that forced them to live with other prisoners in an anonymous cell with virtually no personal space. External, coercive rules and arbitrary decisions by guards dictated their behavior. More subtly, in our prison, as in all prisons I know about, emotions were suppressed, inhibited, and distorted. Tender, caring emotions were absent among both guards and prisoners after only a few days. In institutional settings, the expression of human emotions is contained to the extent that they represent impulsive, often unpredictable, individual reactions, when uniformity of mass reactions is the expected norm. Our prisoners were dehumanized in many ways by the treatment of the guards and by degrading institutional procedures. However, they soon added to their own dehumanization by suppressing their emotional responses except when they broke down. Emotions are essential to humanness. Holding emotions in check is essential in prisons because emotions are a sign of weakness that reveal one's vulnerability both to the guards and to other prisoners. We will explore more fully the destructive effects of dehumanization as it relates to moral disengagement in Chapter 13. Serendipity shines its spotlight on the SPE. What transformed our experiment into a major example of the psychology of evil was a series of dramatic, unexpected events that occurred shortly after our study ended. A massacre at California's San Quentin State Prison, and a massacre at New York State's Attica Correctional Facility. These two events helped to catapult into national prominence a little academic experiment designed to test a theoretical notion of situational power. Here I will only outline key aspects of these events and their consequences for the SPE and me. Please see www.lucifereffect.com for a fuller treatment of the details, along with the concurrent rise of the Black Panther Party and the Weather Underground Radical Student Group. The day after the SPE was terminated, a number of guards and prisoners were killed at San Quentin Prison in an alleged escape attempt headed by the black political prison activist George Jackson. 3 weeks later, across the country in upstate New York, prisoners rioted at Attica Prison. They took over the prison and held nearly 40 guards and civilian staff as hostages for 5 days. Instead of negotiating the prisoners' demands to change their conditions of oppression and the dehumanization they were experiencing, New York Governor Nelson Rockefeller ordered state troopers to retake the prison by all means necessary. They shot and killed more than 40 of the inmates and hostages in the yard and wounded many others. The temporal proximity of these two events put prison conditions on center stage. I was invited to give testimonies to several congressional committees based on extensions of what I had learned from the SPE to prisons in general. I also became an expert witness for one of the 6 prisoners involved in the San Quentin State Prison massacre. Around that time, a media correspondent who saw me in a televised debate with San Quentin's associate warden decided to do a documentary on the SPE on national television, NBC's Chronologue, November 1971. A Life magazine feature soon followed, and the SPE was off and running. Putting the SPE into its zeitgeist frame. To appreciate more fully the extent of the character transformations in our student prisoners and guards that were induced by their experience in our mock prison, it is well to consider the zeitgeist of the late 1960s and early 1970s. It was a time to reject authority, to trust no one over 30, to oppose the military-industrial establishment, to participate in anti-war rallies, to join in civil rights and women's rights causes. It was a time for young people to rebel against the rigid societal and parental conformity that had so restricted their parents in the 1950s. It was a time to experiment with sex, drugs, and rock and roll, and to let your hair grow long, to let it all hang out. It was a time to be a hippie, to go to be-ins and love-ins, to be a San Francisco flower child with flowers in your hair, to be a pacifist, and especially to be an individualist. The Harvard psychologist Timothy Leary, that generation's intellectual acid guru, offered a triple prescription for young people everywhere. Tune out of traditional society, turn on to mind-altering drugs, and tune in to one's inner nature. The rise of the youth culture, with its dramatic rebellion against injustice and oppression, was centered on the immorality of the Vietnam War, its obscene daily body counts, and an administration unwilling to admit its error, cut bait, and exit for 7 bloody years. These values were in the wind, blowing across European and Asian youth movements. Europeans were even more militant than their American counterparts in vigorously challenging the establishment. They openly rebelled against both political and academic orthodoxy. In direct opposition to what they considered reactionary, repressive regimes, students in Paris, Berlin, and Milan manned the barricades. Many were socialists who challenged fascist and communist totalitarianism, and they deplored the financial restrictions on access to higher education. The student volunteers in our study, as a group, emerged from this youth culture of rebellion, personal experimentation, and the rejection of authority and conformity. We might have expected the subjects in our experiment to be more resistant to institutional forces than they were, to resist complying with the dominance of the system that I imposed on them. We did not anticipate that they would adopt such a power-prone mentality when they became guards, because none of our volunteers preferred to be a guard when he was given that option. Even tough guard Hellman wanted to be a prisoner rather than a guard, because, as he told us, most people resent guards. Virtually all of our student volunteers felt that becoming a prisoner was a more likely possibility for them in the future. They were not going to college in order to get jobs as prison guards, and they might get arrested for various minor infractions someday. I take this to mean that there was not a predilection among those assigned to be guards to be abusive or domineering in the ways they later were. They did not bring into the Stanford prison experiment any tendencies to harm, abuse, or dominate others. If anything, we might say they brought in tendencies to be caring of other people in accordance with the contemporary social conditioning of their era. Similarly, there was no reason to expect the students role-playing prisoners to break down so quickly, if at all, given their initially positive mental and physical health. It is important to keep this temporal and cultural context in mind when considering later attempted replications of our study by researchers in totally different eras. Why systems matter the most. The most important lesson to be derived from the SPE is that situations are created by systems. Systems provide the institutional support, authority, and resources that allow situations to operate as they do. After we have outlined all the situational features of the SPE, we discover that a key question is rarely posed. Who or what made it happen that way? Who had the power to design the behavioral setting and to maintain its operation in particular ways? Therefore, who should be held responsible for its consequences and outcomes? Who gets the credit for successes, and who is blamed for failures? The simple answer in the case of the SPE is me. However, finding that answer is not such a simple matter when we deal with complex organizations, such as failing educational or correctional systems, corrupt mega-corporations, or the system that was created at Abu Ghraib prison. System power involves authorization or institutionalized permission to behave in prescribed ways or to forbid and punish actions that are contrary to them. It provides the higher authority that gives validation to playing new roles, following new rules, and taking actions that would ordinarily be constrained by pre-existing laws, norms, morals, and ethics. Such validation usually comes cloaked in the mantle of ideology. Ideology is a slogan or proposition that usually legitimizes whatever means are necessary to attain an ultimate goal. Ideology is the big kahuna, which is not challenged or even questioned because it is so apparently right for the majority in a particular time and place. Those in authority present the program as good and virtuous, as a highly valuable moral imperative. The programs, policies, and standard operating procedures that are developed to support an ideology become an essential component of the system. The system's procedures are considered reasonable and appropriate as the ideology comes to be accepted as sacred. During the era when fascist military juntas governed around the world from the Mediterranean to Latin America, from the 1960s to 1970s, dictators always sounded their call to arms as the necessary defense against a threat to national security, allegedly posed by socialists or communists. Eliminating that threat necessitated state-sanctioned torture by the military and civil police. It also legitimized assassination by death squads of all suspected enemies of the state. In the United States at the present time, the same alleged threats to national security have frightened citizens into willingly sacrificing their basic civil rights to gain an illusion of security. That ideology, in turn, has been the centerpiece justifying a preemptive war of aggression against Iraq. That ideology was created by the system in power, which in turn created new subordinate systems of war management, homeland security management, and military prison management, or absence thereof, in default of serious post-war planning. My scholarly fascination with the mind control strategy and tactics outlined in George Orwell's classic novel 1984 should have made me aware of system power sooner in my professional life. Big Brother is the system that ultimately crushes individual initiative and the will to resist its intrusions. For many years, discussion of the SPE did not even include a systems-level analysis, because the original dialogue was framed as the contest between the dispositional and situational ways of understanding human behavior. I ignored the bigger problem of considering that framing provided by the system. It was really only after I became engaged in understanding the dynamics of the widespread abuses in the many military prisons in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Cuba that the system's level of analysis became glaringly obvious. The Nobel laureate physicist Richard Feynman showed that the tragic disaster of the space shuttle Challenger was due not to human error, but to a systemic problem with official management. NASA's top guns insisted on the launch despite the doubts of both of their engineers and the expressed concerns of the manufacturer of a critical component, which became the flawed O-ring that caused the disaster. Feynman argues that NASA's motivation may well have been to assure the government of NASA's perfection and success in order to ensure the supply of funds. In later chapters, we will adopt the point of view that systems as well as situations matter to aid in our understanding of what went wrong at the Stanford and Abu Ghraib prisons. In contrast to NASA's system that failed when it tried to live up to its politically motivated slogan of faster, better, cheaper, was the horrific success of the Nazi system of mass extermination. Here was a tightly integrated, top-down system of Hitler's cabinet, the National Socialist politicians, bankers, Gestapo officers, SS troops, engineers, doctors, architects, chemists, educators, train conductors, and more, each doing its part in this concentrated attempt at the genocide of all European Jews and other enemies of the state. Concentration camps had to be built, along with extermination camps and their specifically designed crematoria, and new forms of lethally effective poison gas had to be perfected. Propaganda specialists had to design campaigns in film, newspapers, magazines, and posters that denigrated and dehumanized the Jews as a menace. Teachers and preachers had to prepare the youth to become blindly obedient Nazis who could justify engaging in the final solution of the Jewish question. A new language had to be developed with innocuous-sounding words concealing the truth of human cruelty and destruction, such as Sonderbehandlung, special treatment, Sonderaktion, special action, Umsiedlung, resettlement, and Evakuierung, evacuation. Special treatment was the code name for the physical extermination of people, sometimes shortened to SB for efficiency. SS head Reinhard Heydrich outlined basic principles of security during the war in a 1939 statement. A distinction must be made between those who may be dealt with in the usual way and those who must be given special treatment, Sonderbehandlung. The latter case covers subjects who, due to their most objectionable nature, their dangerousness, or their ability to serve as tools of propaganda for the enemy, are suitable for elimination, without respect for persons, by merciless treatment, usually by execution. For the Nazi doctors who were enlisted to make the selections of inmates for extermination or experimentation, there was often a question of split loyalty, of conflicting oaths, contradictions between murderous cruelty and momentary kindness, which SS doctors seemed to manifest continuously during their time in Auschwitz. For the schism tended not to be resolved. Its persistence was part of the overall psychological equilibrium that enabled the SS doctor to do his deadly work. He became integrated into a large, brutal, highly functional system. Auschwitz was a collective effort.